brakes should have been put someplace else. You know, if you're wondering why is the Bible divided into chapters the way it is, this is something that printers in Europe developed as printed Bibles became more and more established in the 17th century. And there's a joke that some of the divisions just seemed to be the printer had a copy of the Bible and he was riding his horse between villages, and just every time he hit a bump, he made a chapter break. Because some of them make about that much sense, okay? But, so we're going to read through a chapter break. What I would like for you to do, take a minute to just read these verses to yourself, and then I'm going to ask you, what are some words or phrases in this that make you go, yay? Or what are some words or phrases that make you go, okay? And don't worry if your is on somebody else's yay. Or vice versa, okay. That's, we could do this almost any place. So take a minute and do that. Okay, do you have a yay or a
Yay God.
Yay God, okay. All right. Yay God. Okay. Lots, of course, there's...
Rejoicing in suffering.
Rejoicing in suffering. Is that a
That's a
Okay, all right. Thank you. Yeah, rejoicing, yay, suffering, Put it together and you get There are. That's a yay. Okay. Okay. What else?
Mystery.
That's a Okay. Okay.
Is hidden be kind of one too?
I think so. Mystery and hidden kind of seem to go together, don't they?
Yeah, they do.
Okay. You guys are into this. This is great. Okay, whenever I do something like this, I think, what if they just stare back at me? You know, and come on, just teach us, you know. But this is good. What else?
Admonishing.
Okay. Why do you want that on the Dennis? Oh, you need some correction.
Yes.
I didn't know I was doing anything wrong. Okay. Is that on the yay? Okay. You're all yay. I appreciate that. Okay.
I think revealed is a yay.
Ah, revealed. Okay. Well, thank you. Okay, and I'm gonna do something here.
If he says he doesn't, he's praying for them. I guess that's what he's doing in the dungeons or wherever.
Yeah, yeah. What do you? Although we should remember at this point, when we think of Paul as a prisoner here, probably not in a dungeon situation. He's probably under house arrest, which is way better than a dungeon, but still, you know, it's like the month of February. You just get cabin fever, I think. What's that?
The food is better.
The food is better for sure. I'm very confident of that. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so being revealed among the Gentiles would be a yay for me.
Okay.
Ah,
good point.
Especially if you keep going down, it's the glorious riches of this Christ.
Yeah.
Well, then it's a yay for us.
One of the aspects is Christ is hope.
Hope of glory.
Okay, hope, okay. I'm gonna put riches on here too. Okay.
Perfect.
Where do you want that?
Yay,
okay. Okay, I'm going to also, for the sake of argument, I'm going to put it, if you didn't, I was going to suggest that you talk to your wife. Isn't that the truth? Okay, I mean, you know, marriage is such a humbling experience. I'm going to put that on both sides, because, perfect? Okay, let's see, anything else that you see? Okay, struggling on the side? Okay. Okay. I don't want to stop us. Anything else? I don't want to prolong it.
Treasures.
Riches, treasures. Yeah, I think there's two different expressions there, aren't there? They're kind of related.
With them in spirit.
Okay, with them in spirit. I have no idea what my phone is telling me. Okay. All right, we have captured almost every word of the text, I think. Yeah, okay.
So how do you really know how we're doing here?
Yeah. Absent in body, present in spirit. Okay. All right, good. All right. We could do more. I'm going to... That brings some clarity to that. Thank you. Okay, the superlatives are Christ. Okay, so I'm just going to say this for the recording. On the A side, we've got God, superlatives about Christ, praying for the Colossians, the term revealed, the inclusion of the Gentiles, hope, perfect, riches, treasures, present in spirit, with them in spirit. I think, yeah, that captures probably from different translations. Encouraged in understanding. On the side, rejoicing in suffering, mystery, hidden, admonishing. What about the Gentiles? If you're not a Gentile, that doesn't sound so good.
Worse to be a Jew, how do you understand? Yeah,
yeah.
Been told to be separate.
Yeah, exactly. If the nations at large have been excluded and now are being included, what just happened to me and my special place in the world? Yeah. Perfect, it raises some questions. Paul talks about the struggle, about being absent in body, all of those hmms. Okay, now, I'm going to do something here just to invite you to think about this. I didn't plan this too well. I'm going to put this in the middle of all of this. All right. How does the perspective of the cross affect the way you might see any of this? And if you say, what do you mean by perspective of the cross? I mean, you're thinking of the story of Jesus, of his death and resurrection, and you're seeing that as the fulfillment of everything that God has been doing in the world. How does that affect the way you look at any of the terms here on either side?
It moves a lot of them over to the yay side.
Okay, that's really good, Mark. Move some things over to the yay side. Give me an example of that. Maybe one specific. Okay, it's no longer a mystery. Okay, the mystery has been revealed. It's no longer hidden. That's why I did the little cloudy things around this. There you go. Okay. Yeah. Rejoicing in suffering.
Well, I mean, you look at what Christ went through on the cross.
Yeah.
But that's where they paid the price for my sin.
It does. And the other side of this is I realize I am united with Christ, and that's going to define my life too. Okay. That when you sign on for this Christianity thing, it's following Christ on the way to the cross. You know, but understanding this is God's abundant life, that it's in this that we find our real purpose and real fulfillment. I want to, well, let's kind of talk about this consecutively a little bit now, because I'll admit, I'm a little, now that we've done all of this, I'm a little confused about how it all fits together, okay, as we've kind of written it. I know, exactly. I just said that to make you feel comfortable. I couldn't possibly admit to being confused. Okay. That would be oh, well, I am. So let's look at this just consecutively. I rejoice, verse 24, now I rejoice in my sufferings for your sake. And in my flesh, I am filling up what is lacking in Christ's afflictions. Now, I thought we might get lacking on the side.
Yeah, that was something.
Yeah.
That
sounds a little disturbing, doesn't it? There's something lacking in Christ's afflictions? Okay. Christ didn't die enough?
He's referring to himself, isn't he?
Well, in a sense, yes, but here's I think another aspect of what Paul is probably talking about. Let's kind of blow this up large. If you read through any of the Gospels, you'll see periodically Jesus will compare himself to Israel's prophets. Okay, and when he does, he is often comparing himself to their suffering and being rejected, even being killed. Okay, a good example of this is in Matthew 23 and Luke, I think it's in Luke 13, where Jesus says that Jerusalem, Jerusalem, who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to her. You know, how often I wanted to gather you the way a hen gathers her chicks. Okay, what he's doing there is aligning himself with the experience of Israel's prophets who are rejected, largely. Obviously, if they were rejected completely, we wouldn't even know about them. Okay, there are always those who listened and who preserved their message. So Jesus is aligning himself with that. And so one aspect of his death is saying, this is the pinnacle, this is the climax of everything that has been going on in the past. God's people are always rejected. They always suffer, and I'm taking that on myself. Let's just pause here for a minute. Based on your fabulous knowledge of the entire Bible, and you're thinking, me? I'm confident we're going to get to the right place with this, okay? Based on your fabulous knowledge of the entire Bible, what's the earliest instance you can think of in the Bible of God's people suffering because they are God's people? Good job. We got right to the beginning, right there. Okay, when Cain kills Abel, he's effectively the first martyr for the faith. Okay, he offers a sincere, acceptable sacrifice. And by the way, what's wrong with Cain's sacrifice? It's insincere. That's kind of the tenor of the text. And Abel, and Jesus makes this point, okay, in, I think it's Luke 11, the blood of all the prophets will be required of this generation. He says, and he says, the blood from Abel, who we know, to a guy we probably don't know, Zechariah, the son of Berechiah. And if you're thinking, is that the Zechariah who writes the book of Zechariah? No, that's a different Zechariah. This is a guy who just is mentioned briefly at the end of 2 Chronicles, okay, which is not the most popular book of the Bible to read for whatever reason. Interestingly, in the arrangement of the books in the Hebrew Bible, 2 Chronicles is the last book. This is not the arrangement that we're accustomed to where we end with Malachi. That's based on the Greek translation of the Old Testament, the Septuagint. But the Hebrew Bible divides things into three categories. The third includes Chronicles, and so 2 Chronicles is last. So Jesus is effectively saying from the beginning of the book to the end, when he says from Abel to this Zechariah guy. So Abel is first. Well, in a sense, yes. I mean, that's kind of the first instance of suffering, but not because they're God's people, but because they're rejecting God. Yeah. Although it's complicated, right?
God's people.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they're definitely God's creation. Yeah, and God is there to redeem them. So as we think about that, Jesus is aligning himself with all of the suffering in the past. That helps us understand why he says to his disciples, if you want to be my disciples, you have to deny yourself, take up your cross, and follow me. A servant is not greater than his master. If they hate me, they will hate you. When I sent you out before, I sent you out without, a bag of money or sandals or a staff. But I tell you now, take money, take a staff. In fact, take a sword, which is a metaphor because a paragraph later in Luke 22, someone uses the sword and he tells him to put it away. But we see that prediction of suffering, of persecution that comes there. When Paul here speaks of filling up what is lacking in the sufferings of Christ, he's not suggesting that Christ's death was inadequate to bring forgiveness of sins. He's saying the ongoing purpose of God is being fulfilled in the lowliness and the suffering of the followers of Jesus. Okay? You and I are, as disciples of Jesus, going to suffer, okay? Just in general and in particular, in some instances, because of our faith. And this is an aspect of the testimony that God gives to the world of what he's doing.
Yes. Thinking of the Old Testament.
Yes. I'm thinking of another passage. I think there may be something like that, but he also describes himself as being poured out as a drink offering, as well. Yeah, and that's a very, very vivid metaphor because in the temple, if you made an offering of wine, they just took the wine vessel and poured that out. Okay, and imagine how offensive that is to people who like wine. You know, what a terrible waste. Oh, my, yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I don't think that was his intent when he gave it.
Well, I mean, he's drawing on that image, to say that. So I'm being poured out as a drink offering. They're not thinking, what's that? They're thinking, oh, my goodness, what a vivid comparison.
And reading the Old Testament, all those things they have to remember.
Well, they do, although... You know, one of the things to keep in mind, if you are a Jewish believer and have been to the temple, you're not just remembering this from what you have read, you're remembering this from what you've seen. You know, this is a spectacle. You know, I think this is always a good check for all of us to remember that the experience that we're having right now of everyone in the room opening the Bible is, in the history of the church, very rare. Okay. No one was doing this until about 400 years ago. Even 500 years ago, as Bibles are being printed, they're still hugely expensive. But like any technology, the cost goes down. As
free service with that church.
I'm sorry?
Some people set through free service. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Yeah, so you know, you typically know the Christian message, you know the Bible from hearing it read in public. And of course, the church in Europe did things like religious iconography. You know, there are statues or stained glass windows and so forth, which remind people of the story or tell them of the story. If we think of Israel's practice in the temple in this light, we realize there are all kinds of things being acted out in front of them that are memorable and provide a kind of a framework for their understanding of their life and their calling.
And their minds were not cluttered with everything that we have.
I hope not.
I mean, well, you yeah. think about it, we have so many things that we fill our minds with. I mean,
yeah.
They were basically focused on one or two things. The big thing was staying alive.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and the second big thing was keeping a relationship with others around them.
Yeah. I'm much less worried about the Super Bowl than I would have been had the playoffs turned out differently.
That's just an example. We still are running.
No, you're right, exactly.
That we kind of push God out sometimes.
Yeah. I'm thinking about the fact that you've been reading the Bible on your phone, which is great. Okay, and first of all, yay for generational triumph, okay, adapting to the new technology. But, you know, that phone is a distraction machine. You know, while I'm talking, my phone is telling me there's something I should be looking at. That's very true. That's very true. Maybe the fact that we diagnose people as having attention deficit disorder now, I don't think that there would have been such a thing in an agrarian economy because you just go about your business. Mm-hmm. You know, you do your thing on a day-to-day basis. Yeah, that's very interesting to think about. Anyway, to come back to this, as we think about filling up what is lacking in the sufferings of Christ. This is not saying Christ's death was inadequate, but it's saying there's more in God's plan to be done, and it's done in the same, let's call it modality, as Christ's death. What does authentic discipleship look like? It's always lowly. It's often suffering. So Paul's imprisonment, he's saying, there's kind of an implication here. You might be thinking that my imprisonment means I'm not having a triumphant life, okay? That all of the superlatives of Christ aren't working out in me. But in fact, they are, because my imprisonment is a part of the, let's use a big word here, the cruciformity of the Christian life, of a life which is shaped by the message of the cross. So suffering in faith is actually one of the means by which God is making himself known in the world. And as Christ, well, let's use another example here. In John's gospel, Jesus says a couple of things along this line to his disciples. As the Father has sent me, so I am sending you. Says this twice, okay? Once before his death and resurrection and once after. And he says to the disciples, you will do even greater things than I do. Because what Christ has inaugurated is being carried out among his disciples. Okay? When we read the book of Acts, it begins by saying, in my first book, O Theophilus, I wrote to you about all that Jesus began to do and teach. Well, if Acts is about what Jesus began to do and teach, or if Luke is about what Jesus began to do and teach, then Acts is about what he continues to do and teach. But he goes to heaven in like verse 12, you know, So he's absent, but he's not. Okay. Because, he's absent, but he's not really absent because he is present with his disciples. And then we see them carrying things out that echo what he did. Okay. Jesus is on trial before the Sanhedrin. The apostles are on trial before the Sanhedrin. Stephen is on trial before the Sanhedrin. Paul is on trial before the Sanhedrin, etc. I'm sorry, Stephen? Yeah. Stephen, well, and there's some particular echoes in the Stephen story there that really stand out. So Paul is carrying this out here and saying this in a very kind of way that at first makes you go, and then you think, okay, I'm beginning to understand here. How in the world is there something lacking in the sufferings of Christ? God's work is continuing, and we're a part of it in that same shape. Yeah, he's still working this out. Yeah.
And so what's lacking is not Jesus' death. What's lacking is the experience and application
yeah.
in the church.
Yeah, exactly. The way that we are continuing to carry out that ministry that he's inaugurated. Yeah. There's nothing inadequate. There's nothing at fault. There's nothing defective about his death. But even though his death completes the plan of redemption, it also doesn't complete it because we're engaged in that ongoing thing. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that helps us capture that very definitely. Let's read some more. Let's see here. Yeah, we need to pretend to get through this at least. So I'm filling up what is lacking, and this verse 25 I think is picking up on what David is talking about. For the sake of his what is lacking Christ's afflictions, for the sake of his body, the church, of which I became a minister according to the stewardship from God that was given to me for you to make the word of God fully known. That expression, his body, the church, is, I think, to people who are familiar with the New Testament, so common to our thinking that we maybe don't pause to realize this is a new concept. And it's a concept in the New Testament which is distinctive to Paul, to speak of the church as his body. Now, there are other parts of the New Testament that speak of a similar kind of unity between Christ and the church. But let's think about it here in specific terms the way Paul is talking about it. If the church is Christ's body, what should they expect to experience? The kind of things that Christ experienced. Okay. So if he suffers and is rejected, we should not be surprised if we do. Okay. Now let's maybe take a pause here for a minute and think about this in light of the way that the Colossians have heard this other story, what we today call the Colossian heresy, this idea there's some stuff that you can learn and you can do that will bring you closer to God. What is Paul saying about being close to the true God here at the beginning of this paragraph? That it's expressed in suffering. You know? That this is not, okay, here's I feel free in the environment of TCBC to use words that I have not used in public in other places. And I don't mean they're bad words, they're just big words, okay? So if you ever feel like, you know, just ask me to define something, okay, if I drop one of these on you. Sometimes we want to live with a theologica gloriae when we need a theologia crucis. Okay, a couple of Latin phrases. Theology of glory is the first one, okay. We want a theology of glory. Yeah, we are. You're right. We're getting ahead of the story. We want the fullness of the experience of God in its gloriousness right now. Okay, we want everything to be right and great. We are, another term that people use, we are triumphalistic. You know, we're all about the overcoming and the victory and the success and the blessing and all of that. And Paul's message is, no, if you're going to have a theology of the true glory of God, then it has to be the true glory of the true God, and that's connected to the cross.
I think that's where growing up at the time when most of us grew up.
Yeah.
Was kind of a handicap because Christians weren't persecuted.
Yeah, certainly in this country. Yeah.
We're a Christian nation. Everybody goes to church. Everybody has this. And really, there was very little persecution.
Yeah. I think sometimes it can be, yeah, that it leads to a kind of a casual, superficial kind of an approach to this that leaves out the whole story of the cross in that way.
Because of false teachings here, the false teachings in our era.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that Christ will give you everything.
Yes.
You know, that you will have health and riches. And
yeah. All the different prosperity gospels that we hear. And I've, well, it's on TV because for some reason people will send checks to guys who say these things, I'm afraid.
He's saying what they want to hear.
Yeah, that's right.
Everybody wants life to go good.
Absolutely.
It doesn't.
Yeah. And it's interesting. Yeah. It's interesting how I think in this country and maybe in other places, we have different kinds of, I would say we don't have a prosperity gospel. We have prosperity gospels. You know, there's the one that says you'll have health or you'll have money. But there are also things like, well, if you really follow Jesus, you'll have great mental health all the time. You know, you won't experience depression or something else. Or you'll have a great family life. Everyone will get together and get along. And everything will be great. Okay. I mean, what's family for? It's to teach us that it's hard to get along, among other things.
Mm-hmm. Are we also talking about, when Paul begins to talk about a whole aspect of Christianity that has been hidden?
Yes.
Which is the Gentile issue.
Yes.
So in a sense, I can see how people would read this at the beginning and say, yes, let's get the Jews together, let's go back to our old glory. Because this is what heaven is like. It's going to be 100% Jewish.
Okay. Yes. Let's talk about this. This is good. Okay. Let's pick up. Let me just because this is helpful. I'm going to kind of pull out a few phrases here that I think are important with this. Let me just quickly capture some things in verse 25. Of which I became a minister. This is in the ESV. Depending on your translation, it may say servant. Okay, servant is a better translation. Okay, not that there's anything wrong with the word minister, but when you say minister in English to people in the West, they think of somebody like me, except probably wearing, you know, my collar backwards. And that's not the term at all. This is the ordinary garden variety term for servant. So I became a servant according to the stewardship from God. Okay, the word stewardship there is the word for household. So Paul is effectively saying, I am a servant in God's household. And this is an image that people would have been familiar with. Well-to-do people, you know, they had servants who took care of things. And they were part of the household. The idea of the Greco-Roman household led by the pater familias, the father of the family, and everyone having their role in that. Paul is saying, I'm a servant in God's household. Well, what is it that God is doing to make the word of God fully known, the mystery hidden for ages and generations, but now revealed to the saints? Okay, I love how you guys picked up on this. Mystery and hidden, but revealed. Okay. The way Paul is speaking here, the primary unknown thing about the God of Israel is now revealed in Christ. Now, this does not mean that we know everything that we would ever want to know about God. But it's saying the you know, the central point, the central question is being resolved.
That mystery begins in Genesis.
It does.
In the beginning was the Word.
Yes, yeah. And I appreciate the way you put that, because it is tied to two realities. The affirmation that God is creator and the reality that the world is in rebellion against God. Okay, there's your two things. God created the world, and so is the world's true ruler, true king, true sovereign. But the world is a mess. I don't know if you've noticed. Okay, and this didn't happen just recently. Okay, it's a mess, and so that raises the question: how can there be a sovereign creator God and a messy world? And the answer is, God is going to take it back. And then the question is, how? Okay. Now, and this is now where we come to this Israel and the Gentiles thing. Have you ever noticed how Genesis 12 follows right after Genesis 11? Okay, you've picked up on this, okay. It's useful that they do have these chapter divisions sometimes. Genesis 11 is the story of the Tower of Babel, which, the significance of which is to explain why the world is a mess, okay? Lots of those stories in the early chapters of Genesis are, why is the world a mess? And the answer is, we are the reason the world is a mess. We're like Adam and Eve, we're like Cain, we're like the people in Noah's time. By the end of the story, we're like Noah. Noah doesn't do real well. There's a part of that story we don't read to the kids in Sunday school. And then the Tower of Babel. We want to make a name for ourselves, but that leads us to misunderstanding, hostility, tribalism, division. Yeah, he does. As an expression of judgment against them, and that prevents them from attaining their ambition. And that story, if you will, is the genesis, if I can call it that, of the nations, along the lines that we would read about that concept in, say, the second Psalm. Why do the nations rage and the peoples imagine a vain thing? The kings of the Lord have taken their stand against the Lord and against his anointed one. Okay. The world is in rebellion against God. Why are we all tribal, can't get along, etc.? Because we're in rebellion against God. Here we go. Genesis 12 follows Genesis 11. Genesis 12, God says to Abraham, go to the country I will show you. I will make you a great nation. Okay, that's the genesis of Israel. Okay, but how does that end? By you, I will bless all the nations of the earth, or all the families of the earth is a more direct translation there in Genesis 12:3. So there we've got kind of the teaser as to the revelation of the mystery. How is God going to take back his world? Well, he says he's going to do it through Abraham and through this nation that will come through Abraham. And by that, he's going to bless all the nations. Now, if you are a thoughtful Jewish person in this first century period, you absolutely anticipate that the Gentile nations are going to come to know the God of Israel. You truly anticipate that. But you probably anticipate it along the lines of what we would call cultural assimilation. That when they recognize that the God of Israel is the true God, then they're going to want to join your nation. Wear your clothes, eat your food, speak your language, follow your calendar, follow all of the Jewish laws. Okay, and this is a part of the teaching that is going on with these false teachers, because a part of what, as we're going to see as we get further into chapter 2, a part of what they're saying is, you need to keep things like the kosher laws. You need to keep you know, just eat the kosher foods. You need to observe the Jewish calendar, keep the Passover and this kind of thing. You need to observe the Jewish Sabbath strictly. All of this is the way that you will be able to kind of climb the ladder to have the experience of God.
Well, I mean, there's a whole heresy that if you want to be a Christian, you have to be a Jew.
Yes.
So if you come as a convert to Christ, you need to be circumcised.
Yeah. Exactly. And you see, I mean, you can see this when you read the book of Acts. You know, Peter in chapter 2 is speaking better than he realizes when he says, this is for you and your children and all who are far off. Because when it comes to chapter 10, he has this vision of all of the unclean animals. And God says, kill and eat. He says, I'm not doing that. I'm not going to eat that stuff. But, of course, that's a prelude to going to the home of Cornelius. And then with all of the circumstances there, he says, okay, now I understand. God is not a respecter of persons. He's not a person who differentiates, God does not differentiate between different tribes. So this is helping us see God is taking the Gentiles as Gentiles. So that cultural assimilation thing that we might have been anticipating is not the way that it happens. The Gentiles don't belong to God's people because they become Jews. The Gentiles belong to God's people because they believe in Jesus. And so this is now the hidden thing that's being revealed. Okay. Now I've got two things that I've got to take in. Number one, the triumph of God comes through lowliness, weakness, and suffering. And number two, it includes people who are different from me. All of which makes me feel very vulnerable, very uncomfortable, etc. Okay, but it also tells me something. Okay, if I want the full experience of God, I'm not going to find it in visions or mystical experience or in particular practices that are, you know, denying me the needs and comforts of the body or following the Mosaic law or anything of that nature. It's all tied to following Christ and being a part of what he is doing in the world, making himself known in this way. Okay, the mystery has been revealed. This is, okay, let's skip on here a little bit. Verse 27. To him God chose to make known how great among the Gentiles are the riches of the glory of this mystery, which is Christ in you, the hope of glory. You notice how he's piling up words there? Just to say, you're getting all of this stuff. It's almost awkward. If this was a student essay, I'd mark it and say, use fewer prepositional phrases. You know, that kind of thing. I wouldn't do that to Paul, but I would do that to a student. Paul gets to do what he wants. Him we proclaim, warning everyone and teaching everyone with all wisdom. Okay? This is not for some. This is not for one kind of people. This is not for an elite. This is for everyone, that we may present everyone. And now we get this word perfect, which I put on both sides, perfect or mature. Depending on the translation, you'll see different things here. The term that Paul uses, in fact, the term that is typically lying behind the English word perfect when that appears in translations of the Bible, is a word which implies the idea that a thing has reached its goal or its purpose. Okay, this is the thing for which, this is the reason for which it exists. Okay, if we were to think of this, when is a hammer perfect or mature? When it's pounding a nail. Okay. Complete, mature, perfect. Yeah, that's exactly where we are. You're going to see these different things. And those are all the attempts to capture this idea. So the idea here is to say it's not unrelated to the concept of morally without blemish, without fault, but it's much more the idea of this is the purpose for which you were made. Okay, so it is in the pursuit of this that you are finding the real reason that you exist.
Well, another aspect of that he's refuting there is I'm giving you everything.
Yes.
There's nothing hidden, no secrets.
Yeah.
You have to go somewhere else.
Right.
And follow somebody else to find out what they're doing.
Yeah, there's nothing to be added. There's always more to be appropriated of who Christ is and what it's like to live that out and experience. But yeah, there's exactly, that's exactly on the mark, Dennis. There's nothing else out there to be added or gained.
Christ is totally sufficient.
Yes. Yes. And living in a life of Christ-likeness is, now we understand, this is the reason we exist. So is Paul's in prison. No one would choose that. But this is, ironically enough, the kind of thing that we were created for, you know, that we exist for. Let me skip ahead here. Verse 2, that their hearts may be encouraged. This is Paul saying he wants to be there face to face. This is in chapter 2. That their hearts may be encouraged, being knit together in love, to reach all the riches of the full assurance of understanding in the knowledge of God's mystery, which is Christ, in whom are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. That's another sentence I'm going to take my red pen to and say, just make this more concise. Okay. But why is he building up all these terms? To say the kind of thing that Dennis is saying. You've got it all right here. So riches and treasure. The term treasure tends to refer less to like an amount of money and more like the place where it's all kept. You know, like the treasury. So you're inside the vault, as it were, with all of this. So so there we see the thing, and then he ends by saying, I say this in order that no one may delude you with plausible arguments. What they say sounds good, but you've got to compare it to, okay, have any of you familiar with the expression OG, original gangster? Okay. No? Okay. All right. I feel really cool for knowing this expression. OG is original gangster, but I think we should reappropriate it as original gospel. Okay, I know that was really lame. Okay. When in doubt, go back to the core story. You know, the divine Son of God, incarnate, surrendered himself in death, and God the Father raised him up. What does that tell me about life, the universe, and everything? You know, that's... Yeah.
Is another way of saying it.
Yes, exactly. That there is nothing missing. There's nothing missing in this. Let's go upstairs so we can get to church on time. It's a warning. Yeah. Yes. Yes. As we think about admonishing, what does it mean to have your behavior and your thinking corrected? It's to bring it in line with this message. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
I have a quick question.
Mm-hmm.